So you want to open up your Bible, surprise, to the book of Genesis. We're going to be spending time there. And we're going to be talking about Lot. And again, Lot is one of those guys, we know some things about him. We don't know a lot about him. But we can see some really important lessons. And I think so far we've really talked about positive examples of faith. I mean, Judah wasn't all positive, but and Abraham's not all positive. And Noah, really, in his whole life, is not all positive. But Lot, I think, is going to be kind of our first example. It's like, most of this lesson is like, don't be like Lot. And I think we need both of those things. The Bible is such an amazing resource, isn't it? That we have good things to emulate and encourage us and inspire us. And we have examples of people who struggled and failed and just kind of failed. And to look at that and say, man, I don't want to be like that. And sometimes it's helpful to have both of those examples in front of us to make us realize I can be like this or I can be like this. And so Lot is kind of on the other side of that this morning. So real quick, just a background, because again, it's Genesis. There's a million names. It's easy to get them mixed up. Quick family tree. Terah is Abram's father, and Abram had a couple of siblings that we know almost nothing about, Nahor and Haran, and Lot is the son of this guy named Haran. And all we really know about Haran is that he died, and that Lot was kind of left alone. And again, we don't know about Haran's wife or like where all that happened, but in Genesis chapter 11, we find out about Abram's family and kind of his situation when the Lord calls him to leave, as we've just been thinking about. And what's interesting about this is that after Haran dies, what we see happening is essentially Lot is going to travel with Abram. We talked about that in the last lesson. When God calls Abram there in Genesis 12, verse 4, so Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. And what does it say? And Lot went with him. And what's interesting about this is that it would have taken a lot of faith for Abram to just pick up and go. It would have taken a lot of faith for Lot to just pick up and go. Now, he's kind of with Abram. It seems like there's kind of an adopted relationship, even though he's his nephew. But I think the kind of faith that we see in Abram, we see in Lot, at least initially, that he is also leaving his homeland, the security of that. He's also having the instability of living in tents, you know, and having to go live with Abram. And so one of the things I think it's important to remember as we get into this is that Lot is described as a righteous man in the New Testament. In 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7, it talks about righteous Lot. And here, as he's leaving with Abram, I think we see, yep, there's faith in Lot. Like, he cares about God. He cares about spiritual things. He's not just a wicked guy who just cares about the world. And I think in some ways it'd be a little easier to characterize Lot as, okay, Lot, bad. Abram, good. Got it? You know, but that's not the way it is it? And that's one thing about the Bible, is it's not just kind of this oversimplified storybook of one-dimensional characters. Abram struggles with his faith, and he lies, and he does bad stuff. And then Lot is described as like, he's a good guy, but he makes really bad decisions. And so we have to grapple with this, is that these are not one-dimensional people, and we're not one-dimensional people. I mean, we can look within ourselves and see, like, I can tell there's things I'm doing right, and then there's days where it's like, wow, I have a long way to go. And so we're going to see, again, as we read, this is a righteous man, Lot, and he's faced with an important choice when we come to Genesis chapter 13. So let's read this together. Genesis chapter 13, we'll begin in verse 2. It says, now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. He went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right. Or if to the right, then I will go to the left. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, and it was well watered everywhere. This is before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly, and sinners against the Lord. So it's really amazing here, because Abram is kind of the more favored guy in this situation, and yet what does he do for Lot? Abram says, Lot, just look at this whole land, and you pick where you want to go, and I'll just go the other way. And so Lot is kind of given this decision. And I don't know if maybe Lot should have deferred to Abram and said, no, like, you're the guy who should be picking where to go. Like, you're the one. God made the promises to you and all this. But yet Lot decides, okay, well, I've got the whole land before me. And what does he notice about the land that's so appealing? It says there in verse 10, he lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan. And it's well watered. Of course, if you're a guy who's got sheep and you're living in people's backyards, then like you want a well watered yard to live in, right? And so like, he looks out and he says, man, like this is a rich, physically well watered place. And it's described even like the garden of the Lord and like the land of Egypt, which, man, when you read in the book of Genesis, like Egypt is just kind of bad news. Like that's where Abram goes when he lies about his wife and like lots of different things. That's another lesson for another time. But Lot sees the physical appeal of land and makes the decision to go toward the east. And you notice that he moved his tent, which he has been living in tents with Abram, and he moved his tent as far as Sodom. I don't know exactly what that means as far as like how close physically he was to Sodom, but what's essentially happening here is Lot is going farther away from the land that was promised to Abram. We'll see that on a map in just a second. But he's going away from the promises of God and going more and more toward the place that just looks good physically. And he pitches his tent toward Sodom, and at this point, Sodom already has a reputation. It's not like he moved to Sodom and it was a fine, upstanding place, and then just like, you know, there were some political reforms and the city just decayed, you know. Sodom was already terrible, and Lot was in a position, he would have known the kind of place that he's getting near to. Again, it wasn't like he was ambushed. He knows what he's choosing, and he's making a decision, it seems like, more based on the flesh than based on trust in the promises of God. And we'll talk more about this near the end of the lesson, but isn't that really the choice that we all have every day? Is to make choices more based on the appeal of the flesh or choices based on trusting in the promises of God. That might put us in a really tough spot. It might look more secure to be in a place where there's cities, you know, and stuff. And we'll talk more about that in a minute, but there's just a lot wrapped up in this. So here's a picture. We don't know exactly where Sodom is, but again, Canaan is the land promised to Abram, and they're in this area near Hebron, and Lot journeys eastward and pitches his tent as far as Sodom over here. It's also notable on this particular map, Moab wasn't really a nation at this point, because Moab hadn't been born. But it is kind of interesting that if Sodom was like right in this area, that it will be the land later occupied by the two nations that come from the terrible things that happen at the end of Lot's story. So that's just a helpful thing to think about. So let's think about Lot, and he's made this fateful decision. He's a good man. He's a righteous man, but he makes a bad decision. And he gets caught up in the wrong crowd. Now, what's interesting about this is, I hadn't really thought about this a whole lot until preparing for this lesson, is in Genesis 14, we have another story about Lot, and I think kind of a wake-up call for Lot. And we won't read all of Genesis 14, but it's the War of the Kings. Man, it's a really cool chapter, like, you know, four kings against five and back and forth. And in the middle of all this, what happens to Lot? Look at verse 10. where it says, "Now the valley of Siddim is full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. But those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. They also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed. For he was," what? "Living in Sodom." So you think about this. We talk about the idea of being guilty by association sometimes. And that when you hang around with the wrong crowd and that wrong crowd gets caught, don't be surprised if you get caught up in whatever punishment's happening to them. This is exactly what happens with Lot. Is he's living at this point, not just pitching his tents towards Sodom, but he is actually now in Sodom. And so when the kings come through and they're fighting over whatever they're fighting about, he gets taken away with all of his possessions and family, along with the king of Sodom. And of course, this is where Abram, this really cool account where he takes his 318 trained men and pursues them and basically whoops up on the kings and takes back Lot and his possessions. And you think about this for just a minute. If you're Lot, and again, you're wanting to serve God at least on some level. You've made some decisions that look good for your flocks and for your possessions. And now maybe, you know, it's like, man, like, well, we're in this well-watered place, but like, man, if we were actually like living in a walled city, like, man, it would be so much better than having to, you know, keep moving all the time and live in this tent. And all right, so we're like, we're in Sodom now. And, oh man, you know, suddenly these armies come and you're taken captive, your family, your stuff, you're gone. And then, to the rescue, you know, maybe you think, that's it. Like, I shouldn't have done this. Why did I ever come and live in Sodom? Now I'm stuck. I've been taken away. But here comes Abram to the rescue. He liberates you. And you've got this choice again, really. Like, okay, that didn't turn out very well. So what am I going to do now? But the thing that we see with Lot is he kind of has made the bad decision. And he has an opportunity to think about what he's done, and it seems like he doesn't make the right choice again. And he faces some of the consequences, but he doesn't learn from the consequences. And so the next time that we see Lot, not only is he not wandering anymore, not only is he like living in Sodom, but when we pick up in Genesis 19, verse 1, where do we find Lot? It says, "Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom." And it doesn't just mean that like he was hanging out by the door so that he could leave real quick. But the idea of being in the gate of a city, that's where the business was conducted. That's where the leaders of the city and the men in the city would come together and would make decisions and things like that. This was the place where people of influence or people who were trying to be people of influence would come together and make decisions and talk about stuff. You read about like in Proverbs 31, where like, you know, her husband is praised, he's like sitting in the gates and things like that. Or Mordecai and like different people of prominence, the gate was where all the important decisions were happening. And here's Lot, not just living in Sodom, but he's like, I don't know if you could say that, on the city council or whatever. Like he's one of the guys really wrapped up in Sodom and in the fate of Sodom at this point. Lot hasn't learned from his decisions. He's just gotten more entrenched in this wicked, sinful place. And again, maybe it was that he said, well, if I'm in Sodom, like, I should at least be like trying to reform. I should at least be like trying to be a good influence on the people around me. Maybe it was that Lot is really trying to be a light in a dark place. I don't know what all was going through Lot's mind. But Lot, I think, was blinded to which way is the influence really going here? You note that when he's here among the city officials, Lot's established himself here. Notice in verse 2, when the angels come here, when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, bowed his face to the ground, and said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's," what? "House." So again, Lot's kind of upgraded, so to speak. He's not in a tent anymore. He's living in a house. He's really settled in Sodom. And he says, "Please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night. Wash your feet, then you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, but we shall spend the night in the square." Yet he urged them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he prepared a feast for them, and they baked unleavened bread, and they ate. And what's also interesting about this is we learn that during the course of this time, that Lot has taken a wife, and he's got kids and all of this. And there's kind of raises the question, well, like, where is Lot's wife from? It was like a really big deal when Abram was trying to later on find a wife for, you know, Isaac, his son, in Genesis 24, about all that. And we don't know where Lot's wife is from, but it may be, presumably, that his wife ended up coming from Sodom. We don't know that. But you just think about this. Here's a picture of a righteous man who's just entrenched himself in the wrong kind of place. He's surrounded himself with wicked people. And we're going to see the consequences of that. And so in Genesis 19, really at the end of Genesis 18, we've already had kind of the debate between Abram and God, and Abram saying, please don't destroy the righteous with the wicked. And if there's even, you know, he starts at like 50 righteous people and like talks God down to like, if there's just 10 righteous people in the city, please don't destroy. And God says, okay, if there's 10, I won't destroy it. And of course, there's not even 10. If you think about like Lot, his wife, the two daughters, and their betrothed or whatever, like even if those six were righteous, like there's not like hardly any more righteous people at all in this place. And so in the beginning of Genesis 19, you've got the visit of the angels to the city, and I think the reason that Lot insists on these visitors, these guests coming into his house, is he knows kind of what's about to happen in this city. He's lived in Sodom for a while now. He knows the character of the people here. And so he's like, no, please don't stay out here in the square. Invites them into his house. And in verses 4 through 11, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, this one came in as an alien, and already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. They brought Lot into the they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great. So they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. What a terrible picture of the degeneration that has happened in the city of Sodom. One of the things about sexual perversion is it just gets worse and worse and worse. And we see in Sodom kind of a picture of just what happens. It's kind of like in Romans chapter 1, where when people decide they do not want the yoke of God, they don't want these rules, and they just cast them off, it turns into things that are just nastier and nastier and nastier, until now you've got young and old men surrounding this house demanding to have these strangers so that they can basically gang rape them out in the street. Incredibly terrible. And this is the place that Lot has chosen to live. And here, Lot, I don't know how to fully explain the actions of Lot in this moment, except that Lot can't think straight anymore. He's been in this wicked, twisted place for so long that when he's confronted with the situation that they're asking for these guests, he says, just take my daughters. You know. And again, I don't think any reasonable person would say that in the moment. Maybe he's just in desperation trying to think of something. Different people have tried to defend Lot's decision. It's almost indefensible. I mean, like, how do you explain? You know, take my daughters and do whatever you want to them? Like, this is terrible. But whatever you think about what Lot is saying here, his thinking has been warped and twisted because of the place that he's put himself. The influence has just torn him down to this is where Lot is at. And you look at the way that they talk about Lot in verse 9. They don't say, well, here's this righteous man who has been a light to us, and how do they look at Lot? They say, he came in like an alien. Oh, and now he's trying to be a judge over us. Maybe Lot had been deluding himself into thinking, well, I can be a light in Sodom. I can change them. I can somehow, you know, do good. And maybe that was noble of Lot to some extent, but Lot, I think, had just been blinded to, he has not had an influence on them. They have had an influence on him. And so God's grace and God's mercy are going to start acting on Lot to try to get him out of this place so that he will not be destroyed along with the wicked. Look at verses 12 through 14. Then the two men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. And so here comes the news. You have to get out or die. The Lord is destroying this place, and you have one shot to get out of the city before it is wiped off the face of the earth. And so he said, "Get whoever you have, anyone in the city." Again, this would be that 10 or less, all of those people. And Lot apparently doesn't know of anybody else except, well, specifically, I need to get my sons-in-law on board because, you know, my daughters are going to marry them, and like we need to get the family together and leave. And Lot has not been successful in convincing his sons-in-law that you need to listen to God. Here's the word of the Lord. There goes Lot again. Talking about the Lord. Again, we don't know exactly how they would have thought of that, but it appears to them that he's just joking. He's just jesting. There's no way that the Lord is really going to destroy this place. I mean, this is Sodom. We've been here, you know. I don't know what their rationale would have been, but they appear to him to be jesting. And how terrible it would have been for Lot to be in the position of this, like, you want to save as many people as you can, but no, like, they're just not believing. They're not listening. And notice in verse 15, the next verse, it says, "When morning dawned, the angels urged Lot again." What does that say about Lot? It's like he warns his sons-in-law, and they're not listening, and then what does Lot do? Lot delays. He's not getting out of the city. He realizes how serious the situation is, but do you see the effect this has had on Lot? He doesn't want to leave. He doesn't want to pull away. Maybe I can convince them, maybe. Again, all the things we don't know is that are going on in Lot's mind, but the pull of his home at this point and his people have a grip on him. And so when morning dawns, verse 15, the angels urge Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city." But what does it say? But he hesitated, or he lingered in verse 16. Again, sometimes we start to see the seriousness of our sins, and maybe we've even had kind of a warning shot across the bow, you know, like we've suffered a little bit from the consequences of our sin, but the world gets its grip on our hearts, and we have such a hard time pulling away. Our friends tell us, "Do you realize what this is doing to you? Do you realize what this is doing to your family and to your life and your reputation? And do you know where this path leads? You're going to be destroyed." And we hear them, and yet we're like Lot in this moment, and we're just like, I know, but maybe I can kind of still have the thing that I love so much and not get destroyed. Maybe. And he's back and forth and back and forth. And so this is the second warning. Get up, get out. And he hesitates. Then, verse 16, but he hesitated, and this again is just the Lord's mercy. "So the men seized his hand, and the hand of his wife, and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. When they brought him outside, one said, 'Escape for your life. Do not look behind you. Do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away.'" So here's the third and final warning, and the mercy of the Lord grabs Lot by the hand, yanks him out of the city. Now he doesn't take him all the way out. Lot still has to obey and has to run, but he puts him at the gate and says, like, "Okay, we're bringing you this far, we're getting you a little head start. Now run! Get as far away from the city as you can. Don't go to Gomorrah, don't go to the other cities of the valley that would provide security for you, but get to the mountains. Just go as far away from this place as you can, because it's all going to be swept away." And isn't that what we need to hear sometimes? Don't just like distance yourself from the sin a little bit. Cut it off. Get as far away as you can. Flee sexual immorality. Flee youthful lusts. Cut it off. You are going to be destroyed. And again, it's like what J.D. was talking about. You cut off your hand, you pluck out your eye, whatever use that may be to you, it's going to be painful, but it is worth it than to stay in Sodom and have your whole body end in fire. And we've got to see the seriousness of our sin. It ends in fire for those who will not run. And even after this third warning, at this point, I just would have been frustrated, I think, with Job. And I think the Lord is a little frustrated with him here. Look at what he says. After the third warning, verse 18. But Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords! Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness with which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, for the disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there." Is it not small? "That my life may be saved." And again, if you were the Lord, if you were the angels at this point, what would you say to Lot? Are you crazy? Like, do you realize the mercy that's being shown to you, and yet you want to like spare one of these cities? And I think Zoar was one of the towns that was going to be destroyed in this destruction of the valley. And he says to him, and yet he said to him, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you've spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the town is called Zoar, which means small. And again, each of the three times, Lot is just stalling for time, stalling for time, stalling for time. When we're confronted with our sin, when we're confronted with decisions that we need to make, do we hesitate? If we do, what does it say about our hearts and about the world's grip on us? And that is unfortunately not the end of Lot's story. If that was the end, it would have been an incredible story of God's salvation out of the midst of things, which it really is. It's incredible that God rescues Lot out of the midst of Sodom and His mercy. We'll talk about that at the end. But Lot's story, the influence of Sodom, is not over. Of course, the Lord rains fire and sulfur from heaven on Sodom and Gomorrah, on the city and the cities of the valley. But there's after this, I just kind of picture, you know, like this huge black scorched spot on the earth, and then there's like this one little town, and that's where Lot was, because God spared Lot. And again, there's lessons in that for us, that God can rescue us, even in the destruction of the wicked, even if there's judgment and things that happen. God can take care of His people wherever we are, but we need to not be choosing to live in Sodom, so to speak. And so in Genesis chapter 19, they're escaping from the city, and starting in verse 23, it says, "Then the sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And He overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But His wife, from behind Him, looked back, and she became a pillar of salt." Not even all of the people that run from Sodom really make it out of Sodom. And again, it's hard for me to imagine Lot. I'm sure whoever his wife was, that he loved her. And that he loved his daughters. And that he cared about his sons-in-law. He tried to save them. He's already lost his sons-in-law, who were back in the city still, not thinking that this was real. And his wife looks back. For all the influence that Sodom had had on Lot himself and his hesitancy, his delaying in getting out of the city, Lot had had, I think, an even stronger effect on Lot's wife. Because as they're fleeing, one of the commands was what? Get out and don't look back. And you think about that. If you're fleeing from the place that has been your home for years and maybe decades, I don't know exactly how long Lot had lived there, but all of your possessions, all of the people that you know, not to look back. And yet that's what happens with Lot's wife. And you think about this. In Acts chapter 7, as it's talking about the children of Israel coming out of slavery in Egypt and all the things there, and yet in the wilderness, one of the things it says that in their hearts they did what? They went back to Egypt. Oh, that we had the meat pots and the vegetables and all these things. It's amazing how selective our memory is, isn't it, sometimes? That when we think back to, oh, the life that I had before I was a Christian sometimes, and oh, the things that... And we just don't remember how terrible the consequences of sin really are. And we're blinded by the world. The pull of the world is we're blind to it. And so I think this is what really happened with Lot's wife, is she may have been physically pulled outside of Sodom, but she suffered the same fate as Sodom, because really in her heart she was still in Sodom. And that's what the Lord wants to do for us, is it may be that in some ways we physically get away from the whatever it is, or we move, or we make some external changes, but in our hearts, we're still there. The Lord doesn't just want us to physically be removed from the influence of the world, but He wants the world to... He wants to get our hearts out of the world. That's the real battle. That's the real challenge as we think about these things. And then we see the terrible, terrible consequences of not just the influence on Lot, not just the influence on Lot's wife who is destroyed, but the influence on Lot's daughters. Genesis chapter 19, verses 30 through 37. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, which, by the way, you think about where he's gone. He's gone from being in a tent to being in a house, and now where is Lot living? In the holes in the ground, in the mountains. Sin cannot deliver on its promises. And his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, which, by the way, he begged and begged for Zoar, but now he's not even staying in Zoar. Isn't that the nature of fear and sin? It's like we beg for this little thing, and then like we're here and we're there, and Lot is just a mess. His life is ruined. And he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. On the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their brother drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. As for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. Such a terrible picture. You think about the type of perversion that we saw with the men of Sodom surrounding the house, and the homosexuality and the rape that was going on there. And then here, where do you think Lot's daughters learned this kind of behavior? Growing up in Sodom. And what's kind of crazy about this is, remember that Lot had almost given his daughters over to kind of be had against their will. Lot's daughters kind of do to Lot the type of thing that he had almost had done to them. That it's kind of against Lot's will. They get him drunk, so drunk that he doesn't even know what hit him, basically. And again, just the consequences of sin are so much deeper and farther than we ever realize. You may have heard the phrase, I'm not sure where it originates, but sin takes you farther than you want to go, keeps you longer than you want to stay, and costs you more than you can ever pay. And Lot's story is just an illustration of exactly that. And so Lot has destroyed his own life, he's destroyed the lives of his family members. His wife is dead, his sons-in-law are dead, his daughters are now with child by their father, and are now going to raise these children in this kind of a world. You think about, Lot never could have dreamed when he chose the land toward the cities of the valley, what it would have done to him. But that's the nature of the world, is it promises so much and it leaves us destroyed and empty. And another note again about this is just that sexual perversion just gets more and more and more twisted. And Lot's daughters are a picture of what happens when we give ourselves over to that. And one other side note here is just the dangers of alcohol. How do you think Lot's daughters knew to get Lot drunk, and that what they wanted to be able to do that Lot would never agree to do with them, they could get Lot to do if they got him drunk? And again, just this, they're wise in the ways of the world. And the sad, sad statement that Lot did not know when they lay down, and Lot didn't even know when they arose. Just the power of alcohol to just numb us to the terrible things that are happening around us, which is why people flee to alcohol in the first place. But you just think about how sad this is. Lot's life has just gone from being one of blessing, when associated with the promises of God, to being one of utter emptiness when pulled away by the allure of the world. So we think about the applications for us. And again, we've already made this point. The world looks good. It looks good on the outside. It might promise a whole lot of security and safety, whether it's the green grass that's good for my job and my pastures. This would be good for business. We need a place to be. We can't stay together, me and Abraham. So I'm going to go to the place that looks like it will support me the best. Even though, there's those cities over there, but they're just over there. We can keep our distance. But then, man, this living in tents thing, wouldn't it be so much better? I mean, we don't have to participate in the stuff in Sodom. I mean, it's a bad place, but we can live in the city. I mean, it would be so much easier and more safe. And I mean, if people come through and raid, then we have a walled city, which, by the way, that didn't work out for Lot, did it? And again, all the things that look secure, that look safe, that the world promises, it just doesn't deliver on its promises. It might for a little while, but ultimately it won't. Don't trust the world, however good it looks. And sometimes the best thing that can happen to us is when we start getting too close to the world and we start making those decisions that just entangle us in the world. Sometimes the best thing that can happen for us is for it to blow up in our face, like it did for Lot in Genesis 14, and for us to get carried away with the consequences of our sin and our wickedness, or at least the consequences of the wickedness around us. If we've duped ourselves into thinking, well, I can be really close to it and still I'm still clean, I'm still good, and just to realize, don't get close. And sometimes, can you look back on your life and have seen there have been kind of these warnings kind of happening in my life, and I'm starting to see the fruit of my associations and of how close I am to the world? Learn from those things. Learn from your mistakes. Judah, when he faced the consequences of his sin, last night we talked about that, and he saw, what have I done? She's more righteous than I. This is my staff and my signet ring. Look at what I've done. Judah changed. Lot saw, I think, or had the opportunity to see, what he was doing, and he just didn't change. Our actions have consequences. And thank God for the consequences that wake us up and help us to repent. Don't underestimate the pull of the world. One of the scariest things about this story is just to see how blind Lot is. And we really need to ask ourselves some questions. I put together kind of a list here of questions about who's really having greater influence. Because, to be clear, we don't need to go out of the world. We don't need to go live in some monastery somewhere, and God wants us to be in the world. And there are times where we can't really help but live in Sodom. That was a choice that Lot made here. But there are times we're surrounded by the world and the influence of the world. But there are times where we make choices to get close to the world, and our thinking is, I can be like them. I can help them. And we just need to be honest with ourselves. And hopefully some of these questions will kind of help us to think about practically, who's really having the influence on who. When we talk to the people that we're associating with, are they listening to me? When I bring up spiritual things, when I talk about God, and I talk about doing what's right, are the people around me actually listening to me? Or are they just kind of lies like, oh yeah, he's just saying some stuff, and he thinks he can be a judge of me, but we're not interested in. Are they talking like me? Or do I end up talking like them? This is one huge indicator of just our our influences. Have you ever been talking with somebody who's been like hanging out with a certain crowd or been watching a certain TV show or whatever, and then they start saying certain things, and you're like, hey, wait a minute, you know, like, you've been watching that show, haven't you? Or you've been hanging out with so-and-so, like, I recognize that phrase, you know. Our speech is one of the things that indicates our influences. And so again, if you're in a situation, ask yourself, am I beginning to talk more like they're talking, or are they beginning to talk more like I'm talking? Because sometimes that can be a warning flag, that can be an indicator of which way the influence is really going. Whose plans end up winning out? If you're with your friends and like they're like, okay, we should go do this, and like, oh, you're saying, oh no, let's go do this, and again, maybe it's a simple thing, maybe it's just an unwise thing that could lead to bad things, but whose plans end up winning out when you're with your friends and you're deciding what you're going to do? Are you able to have an influence on them, or do you always end up going and doing the things that they're planning on doing? Again, how do they react when you talk about spiritual things? Sometimes when you talk with people, it's just kind of interesting. Like sometimes when I'm on a plane and like you're trying to talk with people and get to know them, you start to just say some spiritual types of things, and some people are like, oh, cool, like let's talk about that. Like they start talking back on the spiritual level, and some people, it is like a brick wall. Like you start talking about God and spiritual things, and it's just like, whoop, whoop. Like they're just like, nope, not touching that with a 10-foot pole. Like, not interested, not talking about it. And again, when you're talking with people, if there's a wall there and there's not an open door, I mean, maybe in time, but you need to be honest with yourself. Like, is this the kind of person that if they're not going to listen and I can't be an influence on them because they've shut me out, then I need to think about my association with that person and think about maybe there's other ways I can influence them, but if it's a one-way street, we need to be really, really careful. And here's an important one. What do my friends and my family see about my influences? Because sometimes, again, we're so blind. This is a really side point. But did you ever think about the fact that God situated our eyes inside our head and that we can't actually like look at ourselves from outside? We have to have a mirror, or we have to have somebody else tell us what we look like. We can have like stuff on our face or whatever, and like we can't see it. That's kind of a picture of what things are for us like spiritually, right? It's like we can't fully see ourselves. And we need other people to say, hey, have you ever thought about, you're hanging out with so-and-so, and like you're starting to talk like them, you're starting to act like them, you're starting to be where they are and like do what they do. Do you even see that? Because sometimes it's really hard for us to see that. We need to be willing and have the courage to surround ourselves with people that we can trust, and then we can actually ask them and say, hey, what influences do you see in my life right now? Like, do you see me going the wrong way? Like, I need you to tell me. And sometimes we need to have the guts to go to one another, even if they're not asking, and say, hey, I'm worried for you. And like, I don't know what all is going on in this relationship in your life or in this situation in your life, but I care about you, and I just see you going the way of the world. And we need to talk about that. Like, I don't mean to be judgy, but like, I see it. And like, can we talk about that? And we need to be people, if people come to us in that way, be willing to engage, be willing to listen. And again, just ultimately, what does God think about my friendships and my relationships and my influences? Because even if the people around me aren't seeing it clearly, I mean, maybe they're being swept along like I am, we need to keep holding to God and His standards and His Word. And if it's not something we can see Jesus doing, why are we doing it? Again, we could ask a lot more questions. Hopefully those are helpful. If you've got more, we can talk more about this afterward over lunch. But we just really need to see clearly who's being the influence on who. And again, the consequences of sin are just not only on me. Sometimes we lie to ourselves, or others lie to us and say, oh, it's just your sin. Like, it doesn't affect anybody else. Your sin will destroy you, and it will destroy those in your life. It will affect people that you didn't even dream it would affect. And as we think about our influences, think about our influences not just for ourselves, but for those who are close to us. I'm thinking a lot about this right now, that I've got a wife, I've got a daughter on the way, and thinking about, like, I'm not just making decisions for me, I'm making decisions for my family now. And that's true whether you're still single, or whether you're married, or whether you're dating somebody, or whatever. Like, your decisions don't just affect you. They affect your church, they affect your family, they affect your friends, and when you start making decisions, you think, well, I can handle it, but, like, this bad influence, you know, whatever. No, like, if you start going that direction, you have influence on other people as well. And if you start going that way, it's going to be easier for the people that you don't even know are watching you to start going the same direction that you are. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 2. We're going to end here this morning. Second Peter 2, because this is one of the times that Lot's mentioned in the New Testament. 2 Peter 2, verses 7 through 10. And by the way, in this passage, this is kind of an if-then clause in the book of 2 Peter. And so it's kind of in the middle of this. And God is basically saying, if God didn't spare angels, but cast them into hell, and if God didn't spare the world of Noah, but brought the flood, and if He condemned Sodom and Gomorrah, so it's like three bad ifs, like if God punishes and punishes and punishes, but then in verse 7, it says, and if He rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. So if, then verse 9, then the Lord knows how to do two things. How to rescue the godly from temptation, and to keep the righteous under under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires, and despise authority. We need to learn from Lot that God can rescue us out of evil. Lot was a man who wanted to serve God, made terrible decisions in that. But the Lord rescued Lot out of that. And again, our circumstances and our surroundings, sometimes we can't control all of the influences in our life. God can rescue you. You don't have to be like the world. You don't have to be swept away in the sin of Sodom. But if you have the choice about it, it says that Lot felt his righteous soul, you know, tormented day and day after day by the things that he's seeing and hearing. Get out! Like, don't stay there if you have the choice to choose your influences. Don't get entangled with the world. Hebrews 12 talks about the idea, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily what? Entangles us. And run with endurance the race that's set before. Lot's story is a tragic one. It's one of salvation. God rescues Lot. But it's one of tragedy for Lot and his family and the influence they would have, and even the influence of the nations that would come from Lot. And that's a whole other story for another time. I hope that we'll think about these things. I hope we'll really be honest with ourselves. Again, it's easy with a lesson like this to think about, man, I really hope so-and-so is listening. let's look at ourselves first and seek to resist the pull of the world. Thank you for listening.